We're going to talk primarily this morning about Navigator financial principles and history and tradition and the things that are behind the policy and the procedures. But as George suggested, we will leave time for questions on anything that needs to be clarified. And Al Van Hine is here to clarify procedures. And if Jerry Bridges isn't here, he will be shortly, because he's the architect of most of these policies. Now, just so you know where we're going, I'm going to turn on the light here in a little bit, and you see that we're going to have some comments and observations, very brief ones, in about nine areas. We're not going to try to invoke Parkinson's second law, which is that work expands to fill time available. In addition to Parkinson's law, there's one used here at the Glen quite a bit called Murphy's law. And every once in a while, Russ Reed tells me, he said, well, Murphy's law is in operation again. And Murphy's law is that anything that can be misunderstood will be misunderstood. And to be a little more direct, anything that can foul up will foul up. Well, just so you know where we're going here, these are the nine things that have some comments and observations on. And I corrected the last one in my own handwriting. My secretary is very missionary-minded, and so she had as the last in there ascending instead of spending. Well, the first thing we'd like to talk about, since we're talking about financial principles, is the difference between a principle and a command. In Romans 16:16, oh, Jerry, you are here. I didn't see you. I've been wearing bifocals for several years, but I'm not used to them. I found out that there's one thing that can't be done with bifocals. My 11-year-old daughter had just recently learned to play jacks, so she challenged me to a game the other day, and I found out that's one place it won't work. But in Romans 16:16, it's one of the five places in the New Testament that there is a command or a principle. And I'm going to ask you which it is, and that is, greet one another with a holy kiss. Now, do you think that's a command or a principle? You think it is a principle? Well, if it were a command, we'd be in disobedience quite a bit of time, wouldn't we? I notice that the Living Letters has something translates that to the effect of give each other a hearty handshake. So apparently, Ken Taylor feels that it's a principle other than a command. So when we're talking about principles, we're talking about something that has many applications. And a principle is a point of reference for application. So this is what we're talking about, the principle behind the commands and the policy. Now, the second thing we had written on here, actually the next three are in the same area. What is money? And then the fourth, and what is money for? I want to make a comment on that. It's been suggested that money is compressed time. And I suppose if we wanted to expand that a little, we would say that we have to include energy in there. So money is a sort of a time capsule, a time energy capsule. It's that for which we exchange our time and energy for the most part. The next question we had written on there is, what is the main resource that God has given to every one of us. And that is time and energy. So the fourth question we had on there then, what's money for? What's it good for? And if we wanted to be real short, I think we could say that the purpose of money is to buy time. That's about all it's good for. Time is the main thing we have to offer to God. Money allows us to purchase time to use for God. I was reading a book a while back by a Jewish psychologist, and he devoted the entire first chapter to a discussion of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And he said the key word in their existence, in their original state, was comfort. And the key word after they were turned out was discomfort. So his book was based on the idea that the primary drive in a human being is for the avoidance of discomfort. So, trying to make a spiritual application of this, the purpose for which we want money is to purchase the comfort of doing with our time and energy what we think God wants to do with us to do with it. So we are trying to avoid the discomfort of being frustrated in the work and will of God by not having enough money. Well, I said I was going to make some observations. Now, if there's an application of this, I know when I've been consulted with people going overseas, well, what kind of a car should I get? I say, get a brand new one of good quality. Well, I don't know whether that'd be a good testimony or not. No, here I'm supposed to be a missionary. And I've got a brand new car. Well, I know how difficult it is to have a car maintained overseas. And I've told this particular fellow that we're not sending you overseas to spend your time waiting while some mechanic works on an old car or while you do it yourself. Well, how about the wife taking a washing machine? I know one old-time missionary made the observation that the scripture says you're to leave all and follow Christ. And he said it looked to him like the missionaries brought it with them. Well, how about washing machine and air conditioners and so forth? The theory we're proposing here is that people who are overseas, the best resource they have is their time. And it's difficult enough to live over there in some places with all the conveniences that are available. So if this assumption is correct, the purpose of money, the value of money, is to buy time so that we can invest our time and energy in the way we think God wants us to. Now, of course, non-Christians follow the same principle. And the reason they want money is so they can do what they want to with their own time. And we hope that we have a little more palatable aspiration than that. Okay, now I think we wrote down here, in addition to these miscellaneous thoughts, the evolution of navigator principles, navigator financial principles. When we decided that we needed some kind of a policy manual, what we did was went through all the minutes of the finance board meetings that had been held since we had a finance board, some 10 or 12 years, and looked for decisions which had been made. And it appeared that out of those 10 years of finance board minutes, there were 22 conclusions we had reached of a reoccurring nature. So this was the basis of our financial policies. But as you know, our president has a feeling that anything that doesn't have a scriptural foundation may not last. So he asked us to go through these 22 points and see how many of them had a scriptural foundation. And if they had a scriptural foundation, we should probably stick with them. If they didn't, maybe they, were not valid. So you have in your book, in the section under messages, the 9 Navigator Financial Principles that came out of these 22 conclusions, which came out of some 10 years of finance board minutes. We want to group these 9 financial principles under 4 subjects, and they're not necessarily in the order that they appear. And these 4 areas are the principles on how we raise money, the relation of money in the ministry, accounting, and spending. Now, taking the first one on raising money, the first one we want to look at here is number 6. And in number 6, you can see there, you've got it before you, or up here. Principle of making needs known is to be used as a means of raising money from the Navigators. And then we decided the scriptural principle there is that the labor is worthy of his hire. Dawson Trotman was affected in his early life by Hudson Taylor, and adopted early in his life Hudson Taylor's philosophy that needs, personal or for the ministry, were to be made known to God and to God alone. In the early 1930s, I would say that the need for finances was something that was impressed almost daily, and perhaps weekly. I hope sometime many of those early incidents that only Lila Trotman would know can be written up. But I suppose it happened at least once a week that a bunch of fellows come over to the house and there were no groceries in the kitchen and no money to buy. So Dawson Trotman would take a head count about how many fellows were there and say, let's go shopping. Come up to the cash register with no money, and one of the fellows going along with him, tell her, let me pay for it. And the same thing, that the car would head down the landing to take somebody without a full gas tank, no money in the pocket. But somehow, the journeys were always made. When Dawson Trotman was a student at the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, he used to have a noonday boys club meeting, that is between 12 and 1. He got out of class at 12, and he had to race and catch a streetcar to get to that club probably about 12:30. So one day as he was leaving class, he was running out the front door of the Bible Institute of Los Angeles doors to get to the streetcar. As he went by the dean of men, who was Dr. Hale, he grabbed him by the hand. I grabbed Dawson Trotman by the hand, and Dawson said, sorry, don't have time to talk to you now. I've got to catch a streetcar to get to the club. Well, as Daddy Hale grabbed his hand, he put 50 cents in it. Well, Dawson Trotman didn't have any money for car fare. But he knew that God would get it to him somehow before he needed it, the streetcar. So this is kind of existence that he lived. So as the work began to expand and fellows began to give, I happened to be associated with the Mail at that time. And I knew that there was a lot of mail that was undelivered. And I knew that if a money order was undelivered, if the person who got it had kept the receipt, you know, he could apply for a duplicate. And since I was involved in this, there was a fantastic amount that was lost, and we were always issuing duplicate money orders. So I suggested to Dawson Troutman one day that maybe some of the money that had been for the ministry was not being delivered. So I said one way to find out for sure would be just to send some kind of an acknowledgement, you know, when you get a money order or a gift. And he was not at all sympathetic to the idea. He said, well, that's nothing but a hint. That's nothing but a request. So for the first 5 or 6 years, there was never an acknowledgement of any gift that was given in any way, because this might be interpreted as being a request or a hint that more was needed. Well, I'm not sure that Dawson Troutman ever agreed with the people that increasingly put heat on him. But after income tax and contributions became a factor in the late 30s, some of his businessmen friends said, "Why, you're not even promoting good stewardship. If you would issue a receipt for this money, then the donor could take it off his income tax and he'd have more to give. But you're making him pay taxes that he doesn't have to." So after plenty of pressure, the Navigators was incorporated in 1943, 10 years after being in existence, for only one purpose: to be qualified to issue receipts for income tax exemption. But Dawson Troutman didn't want the fact there was a corporation to go any further. It was simply to meet this need. Well, you remember, you've heard part of this, that after World War II, when most of the people who'd been supporting the Navigators became interested in other projects, that there was a real financial crisis. And Dawson Troutman took, I think it was the most of 3 days to get a loan to find out what God wanted him to do. And when he got on frequency with the Lord, as he told it, the first thing the Lord got through to him on was the question, would you be willing for the Navigators to be financed some other way than the way it's been ever since you started out? And if I could reconstruct the conversation as I remember it, Troutman told the Lord this was an entirely new idea, that it had never occurred to him that there was any alternate way to finance the ministry. But the Lord kind of kept after him and said, well, would you be willing to use some other approach? With the result that he was led to study the life of Elijah, who for 3.5 years was fed by the ravens. And that's a much more spiritual and glamorous way to carry on the Lord's work, is just to have the ravens bring it in. In fact, we can get so proud of our spirituality and the fact that God is honoring us that our ministry won't be much good in a situation like that. It's a possibility. But he noted that after living in this miraculous manner for some 3.5 years, that God told Elijah to go to the widow and let her know that she was going to be his means of support for a while. So he sought from Scripture that there might be another way. So as a result of this, this principle came into existence, the principle of making needs known. Now I think that we're always in jeopardy if we try to dictate to God on how he's going to supply our needs. But at the present, this is a recognized principle of making our needs known and giving others the privilege of using that which has come as a result of their time and energy to free us for the ministry. Actually, in the list of 22, There were two other things that are mentioned in this connection. And one is, great caution should be used in soliciting funds from non-Christians or in using non-Christians in solicitation efforts. Now, this principle doesn't say it won't be done, but it says great caution will be used. And another says, contributions may be accepted from any source as long as there are no strings attached. Okay, now we'll talk about another thing, and that is, this was supposed to be some thoughts and comments on how we get money. The next is, money as it relates to the ministry. Again, Dawson Trotman was greatly affected by some of the things that Hudson Taylor said. And as far as I can find out, this statement was original with Hudson Taylor, who said, God's work done in God's way will never lack God's supply. And I think he never varied from that idea. God's work done in God's way will never lack God's supply. The majority of these nine principles deal in this area. And these have come out of some unhappy experiences. So one of these principles states, the navigators are not to owe any money which cannot foreseeably be paid to the creditor on terms suitable to him. How do we interpret going in debt? Now, I'm sure other people have other interpretations of this, but this is ours. For example, I was involved in a little minor hassle not too long ago between a regional director and one of his area men because the area man wanted to buy a car on credit, and the regional director didn't want him to. So I said, well, what is his financial situation? He said, well, his wife's working. She makes about $700 a month. And he's working, makes about $500 a month. So between the two of them, they make about $1,200 a month. I said, well, how much do they want to finance the car for? Well, they've got some money for a down payment, and they need to finance about $2,000 on it. And I said, well, I think this principle applies that with that kind of income, that they could probably take on a $2,000 debt with the ability to pay it in the foreseeable future. So this is one of the principles. Another thing we have here, every part of the navigators is to live within its income on an annual basis. We've decided down through the years that when there isn't enough money to support a particular part of the ministry, and we get down before God to trying to find out what he's saying, he generally is not saying there's no money in the bank. Now, that's what we knew. So when we try to find out what the message is, that isn't the message. The message is that there is some corrective action that needs to be taken in the ministry, and then there will be money in the bank. So if we pursue the ministry without the money, then we may be working on a presumption. These other things have grown out of experience, such that funds which have been set aside for a specific project shall not be barred or otherwise diverted to any other use until the project is paid for. Again, you see, we're assuming that God wants us to go ahead with another project for which funds are not available. And we keep coming back to this same thing here. Number four, when a specific project is named in a fundraising campaign, the project is not to be begun until the finances are on hand or subscribed. I think there's a chapter in Legendary History that isn't too well publicized. You know, it was a great unifying thing when Lanieri was purchased for some $340,000. But if my figures are correct, it took some $400,000 extra dollars, other than the purchase price, to get this place ready for use. So something happened in the planning and praying. And in 1956, when Dawson Troutman was drowned, the navigators were in debt to local merchants to the tune of about $40,000. And no payment had been made on the most of these accounts for 2 to 3 years. And when a delivery truck came out to Glenary with some groceries, he went by the office and picked up a check on his way out. Or if he delivered a load of gasoline, it was cash on the spot because the navigators had no credit rating. There was no businessman in this community that would extend $1 of credit. It was strictly cash as you go. Some of these principles have grown out of rather humbling experiences. Well, we were talking there about the relationship of money in the ministry. Now, the other area here is in the area. I was in the Navy for many years, and somebody told me once that they had a way of deciding when to start construction on a battleship. And that was, if it was a 40,000-ton battleship, when they had 40,000 tons of blueprints, then they would start to work on the ship. So in financial accounting, I'm sure that some get the idea that we have that relationship between the money and for every dollar, well, there has to be a ton of paperwork that goes with it. But our financial principle number 9 here, all Navigator financial operations, including raising money, receiving, accounting, investing, controlling, and spending, must be a good testimony in compliance with the laws of the land and honest in the sight of God and men. Provide all things honest in the sight of all men. So there is a reason behind some of the paperwork that goes on. We regard it as being a necessity. Now, the other area here, and the final thing we're going to comment on, is in spending. And one of the principles that we have here is that we recognize the principle of human government. Let every soul be subject to higher powers toward the end. Therefore, we cheerfully pay taxes. So, a part of the money that comes into our possession is used to pay taxes. A part of it is used in the ministry. And I think that this will probably never be settled to everybody's satisfaction, but we try to find a balance between necessity, quality, and luxury in what we use in the ministry. I know Billy Graham told Lauren Sandy once, as they were discussing this very area, Billy said, well, I had to make up my mind about what God wanted me to do, so I spent some extended time with him, and what he told me was, Billy, go first class. And Billy feels that he has the command of God whether it's an airplane or a hotel, with who he represents, go first class. Now, I think that we do not have that clear a mandate in every area of our spending, but this is what we're looking for, is the proper balance between that which is necessary, that which is quality, and that which is luxurious. And there were many prophets of doom who predicted that securing lenary was the end of the navigators. And that was based on the fact that nobody could be a disciple or teach people to be disciples in a luxurious setting like Glenary. And those that have spent extended time here have found out that there is a compensation along the line between the requirements of discipleship and living in this luxurious atmosphere. But we feel that General Palmer had some prenatal impressions navigator standards were, and worked on these and put them into operation. For example, there are parts of this building, not this part, but other parts, that are more than 100 years old. But the windows, for example, the masonry, is the original masonry. There's nothing there to deteriorate. The screens are made out of bronze. They'll never rust. The window frames are bronze. Never rust. There is nothing in this building that's exposed to the weather, so it'll deteriorate. The roof is tile. It does get beat up with hail occasionally, but doesn't deteriorate under the elements. So we believe in quality, that it's the cheapest in the long run. But how do you find the balance between necessity, quality, and luxury? That's what we're trying to find in the ministry. Now, as far as spending is concerned, salary spending and an individual's standard of living, we have a principle, number 8, in this. Standard of living, provided the navigator expenditures for salaries or material necessities, should provide a good testimony in the staff member's sphere of influence. And that is something that every individual has to determine for himself or herself. And I think a lot depends on our background. We were talking early about the purpose of money being to buy the freedom to do what we want to do for God. Well, some people feel that in order to have the freedom to be a good testimony, they've got to have a certain type and quality of clothes and their appearance, and of automobiles, and furnishing in their house, and so forth. So this is for the individual to decide. You know, what do I need to be a good testimony in my sphere of influence and to feel the freedom to do what I want to do? Some people who have been Christians for a long time have engaged in research. Why don't Christians end well? Because research seems to show that not many who begin well end well. And they've uncovered about 4 reasons that Christians don't end well. I was just going to mention that one of them is money. But the other 3, and I don't know what order they are in, are pride. Now, you wouldn't believe this. This is what research has found out. Money, pride, alcohol, and sex are the downfall of Christians who do not end well. So we're giving particular heed this morning to this idea of money. And when Lauren asked me to give this session, he said, I'm going to be giving a session on excellence. And if there's any word that's kind of an overview of how we want to conduct our financial affairs, why it's according to that great idea or ideal, and that is it will portray excellence. Okay, now, any question on anything that I've said or on financial policies or procedures? Yes, Doug?
Just a little bit on history. Could you give us some idea of the appraised value of the Glen today?
Well, and when you get into the area of appraisal, as far as the government's concerned, that there's only one fair appraisal, and that is in what they call an arm's length transaction, where there's a buyer and a seller. There's actually a transaction, and you can tell what it's really worth. The Glenary and its furnishings at the time of purchase was appraised by an independent group of appraisers that when Billy Graham was working on it, at, I believe it said replacement cost, $1,600,000. We paid $340,000 for it. But I know when we were talking with one of the architects, the architect who's going to do our new buildings, I just asked him, and I'm sure he wouldn't want to be held to this, but we were standing out there looking over the property from the road, and I said, what do you think that property's worth? And he said, well, I believe that there are developers around that would give you $10 million for that plenary property. That's what a local architect said. So, what it's worth, we don't know. We know that the city is negotiating with the owner of the property along the road to the south of us out here for $5,500 an acre right now. So, Doug, I don't know why you asked the question or what value my answer is, but that's my answer. Yes. Jeff?
What is the thinking behind those of us who may own homes, you know, we're paying on them, and we own them, and we pay a certain equity fee? What is that? How do you come about the fee?
Well, the Navigators, and Jerry, you'll correct me if I'm not accurate on any of these things, the Navigators have not established a policy, which means that there's freedom for an area man to own his own home, be his own landlord, if he wants to. When we are consulted about this, we like to point out the tax implications to the owner of the home because he is a landlord. And as so, he has a special tax situation. It isn't something that can't be handled. It's something he needs to be aware of. But we have not said that it's a good idea for a Navigator representative to own his own home and be the landlord of the Navigators, or it is not. So until there's a policy established, an area man is free to go any direction he wants to go on this. Some of our Navigator area representatives do own the home, which is used for the Navigator ministry. Okay, is there any other question or comment? Yes, sir.
Dick? Jim, it seems like here in number two on the principles, that's just an impression, I don't know. It seems like number two condones taking that checking account that we have, and if our expenses monthly period exceed what our deposits are, that it is approved to go ahead and overspend that. Now, how do you justify that?
I would suppose that, you know, it's understood behind this. Anytime what you've just mentioned is done, there must be advance permission secured. Is that right, Jerry? Is that what we hope will happen on that?
That would be a good idea.
Let me say that this principle is not designed to cover that situation. This principle is designed, like many of these, it grew out of our experience here, that Glen Erie gets, probably 75% of its income in the summer months. So it's the summer months, the income that we stretch out to carry Glen Erie the rest of the year. So this is the type thing this is intended to cover. You know, we know what our annual income is going to be on Glen Eyrie, but it comes in a three-month period. Anybody else want to comment or make a question on that? Jerry, I would, you know, maybe you should speak more to that. This idea of overspending an area account just because that it's a part of a larger account is not an action that is condoned without prior approval. Is that not our attitude on that? Jerry Shagney said yes. So there's no blanket permission to do this, and it's a violation of policy and intention to do this without having made prior arrangement. Of course, the prior arrangement that the headquarters is interested in is, where is the money going to come from? Well, if there's you know, some money in sight a couple months down the road, why, then that might be a justification. Yes, Dan?
How close does the total NAV account get to zero? I just think of our the sum of our personal bank accounts. In other words, some are in red, and then there are a couple for the black. But what does the total get pretty close to zero sometimes, or that fluctuate?
Well, there's a little technical area here. And the technical area is that we do what any business would do, and that is analyze what we would call our float. You know, just you know that on any given day, what your balance is in the bank and what your checkbook shows is not the same because it takes check to clear. Well, we have made a pretty accurate analysis of what that difference is, and rather than let the bank invest that, we invest that. No, with the result that our planning is not based on anybody running their account in the hole. And when they do, our planning's off, and we get calls from the bank occasionally to take some remedial action. Because we do not take this in consideration, don't plan for it, consequently it throws us off when this happens. Is that right, Al? So, Dan, I suppose to be specific, I would say that anytime this is done, it throws us below zero. Anytime anybody overexpends their account without some provision or preparation, it throws us in a hole, theoretically. Okay? Ken?
I have a question, I think, for Jerry. Is there any, in the future, any thought about speeding up the process in which we find out what money has come in during a given month? If we're close, it's really difficult to know what we have. And I think what some of the guys do is encourage men to give to them, and then they send it to the Glen so that they know what is coming in. Right now, it's twice a month. And I realize there's an awful lot of paperwork involved, but in the future with the expansion, are there any foreseeable changes with regard to the amount of feedback we have to what is coming in?
The report's more frequent than twice a month.
Can everybody hear what's being said? Ken's question was, is there any anticipated action to let the area man know more than twice a month as to what money has been deposited in his account? And Jerry's reply is at this time that there is nothing being planned to let the area person know any oftener than that. Now, to what degree is that a critical need, Ken, or anybody else that wants to speak to it?
Well, I think it's probably more critical when you're real close. If you're not, you know, if you're operating a month ahead of time, which is ideal, there's no problem. But when you don't know if you have anything, and you don't know what's coming in that month, it's hard to plan.
Yes. Now, I think that we should say that, and I think we're all agreed on this, that the function of headquarters is to serve, and that if this is a need and a necessity, why, you know, we're not set in concrete in what we're doing. couple other people wanted to comment on this. Harvey?
I can, of course, identify with the problem here, particularly when finances are not coming in, but the, this is where the principle of operating a month ahead comes in. And this is what we've been striving for, but have not yet been able to accomplish that, of getting income a month ahead and operating on it. So that we actually can see what we do have. We need to spend that money for our trunks and then and so on. I think this would eliminate that problem.
I don't remember where I read it, and I'm not thinking about anybody that's spoken up, but I did read that God's method of raising money is not his method of raising money. It's his method of raising men. And I think there will never be a time that a large part of the Navigator staff will not be undergoing some training in the realm of finances. Chuck, Steve?
I'm just going to comment the same thing Hart did. Theoretically, I don't know if it's overall policy, but I know what our division is, that we should be striving for that point where at the end of the month we have the next month's budget already in hand, so we're operating on what we know. What we don't know, theoretically, or practically, we're still getting trained.
Roy?
If an area rep keeps a minimum, builds up a minimum balance as a cushion, say $500 in his account, and then is that included in your float? Do you take that into consideration? I'm speaking of, say, If a rep could build up, say, $500 as a cushion and then just kind of, in his mind, forget about it. But he can always write checks kind of, you know, into the red on his checkbook because he has that cushion in his account.
Yeah, you said we include that in our float. Well, if we did, it wouldn't affect the availability of money for you. A question was asked here a while ago about, I think by Dan, how much to put us in a hole. Al, now most of these accounts are handled through the First National Bank. At the peak of deposits, what would the bank show our deposits in the First National Bank for our area and overseas ministry?
Sometimes it's around 140,000 peak, and then it will drop down to close to zero when you get close to mid-month or end of the month before the deposits are made.
Yes, it may show us as high as 140,000, and this takes into consideration that we have made judicious use of another 200,000 on top of this. So if the bank had the money that passes through, well, that balance would be up in those areas right there. I was just reflecting this week that from the years 1953 to 1963, when the mortgage on the Glen is being paid off, we had to raise a payment of $26,000 every year for the principal and interest, $20,000 principal and $6,000 interest. And that was always a big deal that we worked on for about 2 months. Well, if you would just do a little arithmetic on the money that is required to support the Navigator ministry as of 1972. Our daily requirement from all sources is in the vicinity of this $26,000 per working day, figuring 5 days a week and taking out the holidays. It comes into some place in the Navigators overseas or here per working day. Okay? Is there any other comment or question? Yes, Barbara?
How did we get rid of our debt to the local merchants?
How did we get rid of our debts? Well, there's no secrets in the Navigator's work. And I don't want to, I want to make sure that we don't misrelate these two. But after what seemed the untimely homegoing of Dawson Trotman, some of our very prominent friends rallied behind and asked that memorial gifts be sent in. So within a few weeks after Dawson Trotman drowned, special memorial gifts were sent that allowed us to pay off that indebtedness. It was all cleared up within 6 weeks. Harvey?
In 1964, weren't we deeper in debt to the tune of around $160,000 or something like that again? Or was that not the local purchase, but overall?
Yes, if you want to discuss that little period in Navigator Financial History, that part of it is described in this sketch on Navigator History, that we made deliberate plans as a result of a week that Lauren spent up at Eagle Lake. Actually, the thing had kind of a humorous background to show how the Lord sometimes prods us. But we decided that we needed some outside advice. So we lined up 8 or 9 people and asked them if they would sit with us for 3 or 4 days as an advisory committee on the Navigator ministry and procedure and policies and so forth. And so letters were sent to them. They consented. We set a meeting date. And then we discovered that we didn't have any plans, strategy, procedures, and policies on which we needed their advice. So we had to do some pre-meeting work to come up with some things on which we wanted their advice. The Navigators, from Dawson Trotman on down, has resisted growth and expansion. That was the life story of Dawson Trotman and Lauren Sanney when he first took over. So as a result of this, that we had to come up with some long-range plans to get some advice on, he spent a week, went up to Eagle Lake, spent a week just alone with God to find out. Well, he came back after about 3.5 days, gathered all of us around. We were very eager to see what God had told him. And this is listed, not the background, in this little sketch you have on Navigator History, but as he got us together, opened to Isaiah 52, and said what God said was that we should begin to make provision to take care of multitudes that are going to come in from every direction. You know what Isaiah 52 is all about. And, of course, he went into great detail about that the children of the barren were going to be more than the children of the fruitful. So we made a decision that the orders from God were full speed ahead. Now, we realized that this was going to take more money than we had. But we set up a finance-raising campaign called Project 63. And this was all arranged together to have a major expansion. Now, we realized in advance that there would be a little lag between the time we set this in motion and the 3-year commitments begin to come in. So the Navigators did not borrow any money. Well, we did borrow money, but we were behind in our operations, you're right, $160,000 in 1963. But this was a deliberate thing that was stretched out. And in 1964, the corner was turned as a result of this finance-raising campaign. And as far as the overall operations of the Navigators, we have shown a surplus every day since about mid-1964. But that indebtedness was deliberately projected. You see, the expansion was projected, the fundraising was projected, and that does not fit in with these principles. That wouldn't fit the principles that we have right now. And that's probably one of the reasons that we have them right now, but that's that little period of history. Bruce?
Getting back to this idea of standard of living, it seems that this is a relative thing, and we're always wrestling with this. Could you give us some suggestions on how to arrive at this balance between testimony and the quality or the production and ministry that we're involved in?
Well, as far as I know, that I have never sat in a meeting where this has been discussed And I have never had an idea which seems to, you know, be something that's constructive in this area. It seems to come down to conscience, you know, individual conscience. If there's just no broad application, I think an extreme on either side is obvious. But the great big middle area, it's a matter of personal conscience and conviction. Charlie?
Jim, what provisions are being made? I know there's some work being done on this. And so I'd really like for you to talk about what are we doing long-range planning-wise for the navigators as a whole 20 years from now and so forth.
Now, you mean the the lame and the lazy and the senile and so forth? Okay, they're talking about the, let's see, we used to say the sick, lame, and lazy, yeah. But we'll have to add that, the senile. Well, I think it would be unrealistic to assume that everybody is going to die in the harness with their boots on. I also think it would be unrealistic to assume that the younger, highly motivated staff that we have coming up will be patient with the sick, lame, and lazy, and the senile, occupying positions where it may seem that they slow the movement. So I know we talked about this several years ago, and somebody suggested that the old boys are trying to figure out some way so they can retire early. And my response was that I think that the younger boys will do a great deal more thinking and have a great deal more to say about when the old boys retire than the old boys themselves. So, yeah, Charlie, this is an area in which we need to be realistic. In just doing some simple calculation, suppose that between age 65 and 75, the minimum that a couple can get along with is $500 during that period of their life. Now, that's being very conservative, isn't it? Well, $500 a month, that's $6,000 a year. For 10 years, that is $60,000 that's got to come from someplace to take care of a couple between the period and 75. So for the first 100 couples, the amount required to take care of people who theoretically are not doing anything visible, they might be praying and have a ministry, but it'll take $6 million for the first 100. And of course, if you increase $500 a month, if that were a standard today, by 4 or 5% cost of living rise every year, why, we are talking about a little bit of money. Now, Jerry Bridges has come up with a proposal that we're going to give preliminary consideration to next month, isn't it, Jerry? We've got a meeting of the Finance Board on this matter to consider his proposal. And the heart of the proposal is that the navigators, starting January 1st, 1973, now, understand this is a proposal. It hasn't even been discussed by the Finance Board. But starting January 1st, 1973, will voluntarily elect to participate in Social Security. Now, we are not under Social Security now. We're not required to because Social Security is a tax, and we are a tax-exempt organization. But we can voluntarily be taxed for Social Security purposes without jeopardizing or changing our other tax status. So if we decide to do this, each one of you will get a petition to sign, a request to sign, that you voluntarily consent to have your pay taxed for Social Security purposes. Well, if we go under Social Security as of January 1st, 1973, then, of course, you, a half of that tax will come out of your own pay. The other half is paid by the employer. The maximum Social Security benefit that's being paid today is less than $500. So in the proposal, the Navigators have a long-range staff benefits program designed to produce money to make up the difference between the $500, whatever that is, plus the cost of living, and what Social Security would pay. So that's where we are right now, Charlie, in this. Harvey?
Maybe Jerry would answer this one, then I'll say on this proposal, would this half of this tax be paid for retroactive Social Security?
No. No, that...
If any retroactive things need to be made up for them, that would be up for the individual.
Well, there's no way of making up Social Security retroactive. The way Social Security operates, that you have to be covered for an 18-month period before it becomes effective. And if you've had an 18-month lapse, and probably many of you have had Social Security, but if you haven't made a payment for 18 months, any payment you've made is just suspended. It's in limbo. But once you've become covered for 18 months, then that money that's now in limbo is resurrected. But that's the only way that you can rescue any payment is by being active 18 months consecutively. And then it's automatic. So you salvage all the Social Security payments you've made. I might just say technically that that's really to your detriment, because the base on which Social Security is the base on which payments are made is going up all the time. And probably that you had a long time ago is a lower monthly rate. But you have nothing to do about that. It has to be averaged into the overall in figuring your benefits. Okay? That snow anybody? Well, Roy, go ahead.
The Social Security benefits then are not standard across the board, but they depend on how much each individual is putting.
Yes. There is a maximum and a minimum. And the way the Social Security Administration would figure our benefits would be to take the years that you've been under it, take out the five lowest earning years, average out all the rest, and that's the basis of your income. I might just suggest here that a part of the assumptions in thinking Social Security is the right route to go, we find people are concerned more about catastrophic medical bills, have to get old, than they are about monthly income. And Social Security by far provides the most economical and most comprehensive medical protection for retired people. Gordon?
Our people that live overseas as missionaries have a standard of living, and in each of the countries that they're in, to what level of society do they correspond?
Jerry, you did extensive research on this, and we know what was pegged for the U.S. This was not universally pegged. Would you like to speak to that?
It varies in every country. And I can't really give you an answer on that. When we first set out on our program, we were trying to define a standard of living worldwide that could be applied across the board. We concluded that there is no such thing.
Now, you're aware from what you've seen in print that the base of our present pay scale would be to compare us with teachers that would be the strata of life. And as I remember, the overseas people said, I think they said, Jerry, if I remember correctly, well, that's as probably as average as anything you could pick out. But in some countries, teachers get low pay, and the compensating factor is the prestige of being a teacher. So recognition doesn't always come in the form of money. So there is no across-the-board thing that we found. But that teacher would probably be the nearest to it. Yes? Now, any a person serving overseas after they have established as an overseas resident, which takes 15 months there, does not have to pay United States income tax on income under $20,000. So as long as you keep your income under $20,000, you will not have to pay U.S. income tax after having become an overseas resident. Countries vary. In most of the countries where that our people are operating, they do pay income tax to the local government. And I might say that there's some foreign governments that have a pretty simple income tax and Social Security system. For example, Holland. You only have three figures. One is, what was your gross income? And then you take 8% of that. So you've got gross income, 8%, and then the figure you arrive at, that is your tax. Social Security income, it was a few years ago. It's probably gone up now. Yes, sir.
And what trends can you see, say, 20 years ago, or just any trends that exist now as far as raising funds for the Navigators and as far as the style of living? Is it negative, positive, or the style of living, and also would it be easier or hard for raising finances in years?
Yes, well, don't hold me to this. There's one principle that we didn't review in here, and that is number five. The best source for raising finances is from those in whose lives we've had a ministry. And it seems that the broader the ministry, you know, the broader the base. We have a built-in system in the United States. You remember Doug Sparks in his presentation said that this is not true overseas, that we're approaching a point where that the reaching of people and influencing people and the finances to support the ministry will not follow in the same proportion it does in the United States. So the overseas men see that this is a need. South America, I suppose all of our overseas people see this. So that's something that a problem is going to have to be solved in the overseas ministry. Now let's see if that's the rest of your question here.
What's the trend on the style of living, say, from this stateside?
Well, let me suggest my personal feeling is that this is a continuing hazard or temptation. And if my friend was correct that I quoted a while back, the primary drive of a natural person is the avoidance of discomfort. And that's generally the reason that we are after the creature comforts, is the avoidance of discomfort. Isn't that correct? But what's the trend? Well, we've probably got as many observers as we have staff members. That's what the trend is. So it's got to come back to conscience and conviction. I couldn't say there is a trend, but I think there's an ever-present danger of an adverse trend developing. Well, looks like we're working on Parkinson's Law here. Almost. We'll take time for one more question and then let you out at least 5 minutes early, if there is one. Yes, Kirk.
Say going into an area and you have your budget and, you know, plenty of money coming in, and then you start ministering to new people, and people are going to want to start giving to the ministry, and you already have, you know, plenty of money, and you still, it's still a good idea for them to start giving. What would be some guidelines on that?
Well, I don't know. I think I've heard my comment be one-sided on that, but I read about the fellow who'd been converted, was being baptized. It was out in the country, and it was a country baptism, and all the people were around. He got out, and they held up the proceedings with the ministry. He said, wait a minute. You know, everybody's looking. And everybody watched him as he went back to the shore, got his clothes and got his wallet out, and carried it back out to be baptized. And the minister was a little upset and said, after all, this is an honest crowd. You don't have to worry about somebody stealing your wallet. Just those few seconds, you're going to be under the water. And the canon said, oh, no, you missed the whole point. He says, my pocketbook's been converted. And it's going to be baptized too. So there are many people in, or some people, in working with an individual feel that this area of his life is an area that needs to be dealt with pretty early in the game. Otherwise, you can find out after a year and a half that he has no intention of yielding in this area. So I feel in the matter of encouraging people to give, that this is something that needs to be built into their lives entirely apart from your need, from your own need, the need of the area. There are needs. So this is something that needs to be done.
Could it be given to you and then, say, put in the general fund, or just encourage them to give to the general fund?
Well, encourage them to give where there's a need, yeah. Be sure to provide a project. If you don't happen to have one in your area, why, they are projects in existence. And the primary purpose, you know, is not your need, the ministry's need. It's his need for this grace to be developed in his life. Okay. Well, if there are other questions, I know that Al Van Hine and Jerry Bridges are experts in all areas. And as I anticipated this session, and saw in your evaluation form, you had to evaluate all the sessions 1 through 10. I knew which one was going to be number 10. So you can go ahead and put it in. There were 9 of interest, and then that's the bottom. Okay, let's stand for a word of prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you this morning for the way you have prospered this work, and we believe your work, done in your way, will not lack your supply. We pray that you will protect us from the hazards of self-indulgence, and that you will be able to trust us with everything that's needed, and that this ministry will never be hindered in any way. And we pray that you'll help all of us carry out all of these principles which are founded on what you said and what you desire. For Christ's glory. Amen.